It's a pleasure to welcome back all of you to this final live session of Wydemoat Investing Summit 2013. We have saved the best for last, you might say. Really looking forward to this session. It will unfold as all of our live sessions do. First, our instructor will give his prepared remarks, and then we'll have a Q&A session. Of course, you're welcome to type your questions into the online interface at any time. This session is being recorded and will be available in our online conference area within 24 hours. And I'd now like to ask Oliver to introduce our instructor.
Well, thank you, John, and welcome to all of you. It's my pleasure to introduce Jeff Stacey, the founding partner of Stacey Muirhead Capital Management. Jeff has nearly three decades of investment experience. He has established his current firm in 1994 based on a few simple and enduring principles, including thinking about stocks as a part ownership of a business, maintaining a proper emotional attitude, insisting on a margin of safety, staying within a circle of competence, and concentrating investments in a limited number of companies for the long term. This will, of course, sound very familiar to all of us value investors, so I look forward to and will now turn it over to Jeff to tell us how he applies that philosophy when it comes to a specific investment idea which he has prepared for us today. And with that, Jeff, please take it away.
Thank you very much, Oliver. I don't know if you've saved the best to last, but it's certainly a pleasure to be here. And let me start by just congratulating you, Oliver, and John as well. I think the value conferences that both of you organize and put on are just terrific, as is your publication, and it advances the craft of investing, and that's what we're all trying to do, and so thank you very much for having me on. Today, what I thought I would do is just start with a few quick random musings about Wydemoat Investing, some things that we've learned, and then talk very briefly to our investment philosophy, and then take you through an example of something we currently own. One of the themes that I think's come out over the last couple of days is that prices have moved up, and the idea flow is not as compelling as it once was. I guess I would describe the idea I'm going to present later as not necessarily a table pounder, but we still think it's okay from here in terms of an entry point. So with that said, a couple of musings on Wydemoat Investing. I think all of us agree that it's the right way to think about things and to try and find businesses that have enduring, sustainable competitive advantages and make that the pond in which we fish. I would just say it's simple but not easy to do. And, you know, even the greatest Wydemoat investor of all time, Mr. Buffett, we have the example of newspapers where he missed that disrupting force of the internet. And so although it's the right way to think and it's the right way to go about the task of investing, I will just say it's simple but not easy to do. So one of the things that we say at our firm is try and stick to the basics. And although we certainly do spend time thinking about the business models of various companies and what makes them special, at the end of the day, you still have to come back to the basics of the numbers, and we'll talk more to that, but certainly high return on capital businesses, the ability to grow revenues and net income over long periods of time, not every year, but over long periods of time, we think are the basics. And, you know, I was struck by Donald Yakman's comments yesterday where he shared the story of his son trying to understand what his dad did in business, and he said, so let me, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think I have the story correct. He said, okay, Dad, let me understand this. You're just trying to buy an above-average business, at a below average price, and on average that'll work out over time. And that certainly resonated with me, and it's the way we think about things. And so this notion of stick to the basics, I don't know if by sticking to the basics you always end up with a wide moat, but I think for sure you end up with an above average high quality business, and you'll likely be okay if you haven't paid too much for it. So those are just a couple of quick thoughts on wide moat investing. There's nothing, there's no rocket science there, but we think it's important to think in those terms. Our investment process. This won't surprise many of you. You know, we spend a lot of time. We try to answer three questions about any business we're looking at. Does it possess outstanding business economics? And that's all the things you've been hearing about over the last couple of days: high returns on capital, good balance sheets. We certainly like to see net cash on the balance sheet if we can, or no debt and cash. You know, as I mentioned earlier, growing revenues, margins, all the standard kinds of things that you look for in a really good business. And then we just try to make an assessment about management. Are they honest? Are they capable? Has to be both. And certainly, I think underlying that is just this notion, are they aligned with us, and do they think and act like owners? Because that's critical to the equation. And then, it won't surprise you, can it be purchased at an attractive price? And as all of you attending this conference know, with great businesses, you're never going to get a bargain basement price. All you can hope for is usually a decent price. And you know, we're certainly in that camp where we're prepared to pay up a little bit to get merchandise that we think is above average. And so the phrase we've coined around our shop is, we're looking for a great business run by great people at a great price. So with that, let's move on to the example that I wanted to present. Company that may be familiar to you, Schindler Holdings. It's a Swiss company involved in the elevator and escalator industry, and they have the tagline, "We move 1 billion people per day." I think that's an interesting way to think about this business. And so let's try and break it down and understand it along the three parameters that I laid out to you a moment ago, and how we think about businesses. So first, just to give you a flavor for it, there's a number of their installations just going across the bottom row there. The left-hand side is a mall in Switzerland. The middle at the bottom is the Johannesburg Airport, and the far right is an installation on a cruise ship, the Costa Luminia. So it just gives you a flavor. I think intuitively you all understand the escalator and elevator business and what the products are. Commonly called mobility solutions. So let's attack the first question. Does it possess outstanding business economics? And I'll try and take you through a little bit of background first, just so that you can put this into context. The business was started by Robert Schindler in 1874 in Lucerne, Switzerland. So I'm from Canada. Canada as a country started in 1867, so this business is almost as old as the country of Canada. That seems to suggest that it's enduring and that they've done a good job. As is obvious, it's one of the world's leaders in the elevator and escalator industry. It's number two by market share at present behind Otis, and we'll talk to the competitive landscape further in a moment. It operates in more than 100 countries globally with over 45,000 employees. So this is a large global business. We like that generally, to have streams of revenue and cash flow coming from many, many countries around the world. We think that diversifies risk. And what is very interesting about this company, for as old as it is it still family controlled? Now in the fourth generation, Alfred Schindler is the chairman. It does have professional management, and we'll talk more to that in a moment, but we think that's very interesting. So just some quick background on Schindler. Let's move on. What are the big trends that are impacting the elevator and escalator business, and why does that make the long-term outlook encouraging? Well, the first one, urbanization, and this is happening around the world. There is a movement to cities and to urban settings, and when you move into urban settings, you also go vertical, and when you go vertical, you need elevators and escalators. So the implication of that urbanization is, of course, global growth that's probably above GDP. Everybody talks about emerging markets and the wealth creation in emerging markets, and certainly that creates a separate dynamic for the E&E business. Energy efficiency is a big concept. The new generation of elevators run much more efficiently from an energy perspective, so that drives the refurbishment business, taking old elevators out of use and putting new elevators in, or modernizing or refurbishing existing elevators to get more energy efficient. We think that's a trend that will absolutely continue for the industry. And then demographic change, just people are getting older, the increased importance of safety and reliability, and we think this plays to companies like Schindler. Someone trying to get into the business and do an installation of a 50-story building, I think it's a pretty hard-selling proposition. Well, you know, we're ready, willing, and eager, but we've never done one before. And so that plays to the competitive advantage of Schindler and the other main players in the industry. So those are what we see as the main trends, big global mega trends that are out there and affect this business. I think one of the things that's interesting about the elevator and escalator business is you have a very favorable competitive landscape, and you have essentially four main players that have well over an 80% market share. I've seen it, you know, as high as 90, but comfortably saying that these four companies, so Kone, Scandinavian country or a Scandinavian company, elevator company, very successful. Otis, which is a subsidiary of United Technologies. ThyssenKrupp Elevators, which is part of ThyssenKrupp, a very large German company, and then Schindler. And so, as I say, they have over 80% market share at present, excluding China. Now, China has been a little bit more diverse market, and so even including China, we would say that these four companies have over a two-thirds worldwide market share. And then the other players you should be aware of in Japan, there's Fujitec and Mitsubishi. They tend to have a pretty large share in Japan, but haven't translated as well into other markets outside of Japan. So very, very favorable competitive landscape when you can get a limited number of companies controlling or having very large market share collectively of the industry on a global basis, and we like that. Attractive business model. So let me walk you through this. Maintenance is really the key to this business, and so I've often heard, you know, the Gillette model, selling razors versus selling razor blades. And so in a sense, installations, both new and refurbishments, are the razors, and maintenance are the razor blades. But maintenance is the key. So you won't be surprised. New installations and refurbishments tend to have lower margins. And I put a range in here reflecting sort of data across all the companies, the four main companies, but kind of 5 to 12% margins on average. But maintenance services have much, much higher margins, 25 to 35% on average. Of course, new installations and refurbishment lead to even more maintenance. So it's really this maintenance that's the key and makes an attractive business model. And, you know, in Schindler's case, as with the other players, they are really trying to build out their service model globally and have maintenance everywhere. Again, interestingly enough, in China, there tends to be independent agents that are doing a lot of maintenance, but we think that represents an opportunity in China for Schindler and the other players. In the case of Schindler, well over half of their profits come from maintenance. Now, they don't break this down, and again, you have to try and piece it all together. I actually think the number's much higher than half. I think the number's closer to probably two-thirds to 75%, but, you know, certainly well over half. And, you know, whether economies are good, whether there's new building going on or not, you need to maintain your elevators. Certainly in many most developed countries, it's a matter of law, and there's very stringent guidelines about maintenance. But even in countries that don't have those legal stringent requirements for maintenances, a landlord just isn't going to risk something, cut corners with maintenance. And of course, this plays to the manufacturers because they know their product line inside and out, so they can maintain it in a more costly more cost-effective fashion than an independent in many, many cases. So that, we think, is something that makes this a wide moat, and if not a wide moat, certainly a very, very attractive business. Just a sense, I mean, both an opportunity and a risk, I suppose, at the same time. If you look at the growth year over year, meaning 2011 to 2012, I mean, Asia Pacific is accounting for the lion's share of that. China about 72%, India about 14%, with the rest of the world only at 14%. Obviously, we worry and think about construction slowing up. But again, I remind you that even if construction slows up, the maintenance part of this business will be a key driver to profitability. So let me run you through. There's no magic here in terms of this, but we really look and we think if there was one test to live or die on, what is the return on shareholder capital over time? And that's a test of a great business or a wide moat, and so I've just given you the last 5 years here, but you can see, solid 20s return on shareholder equity, which we think is pretty attractive, and in a moment I'll talk to the balance sheet when you look at the cash they're carrying on their balance sheet even more so. So I'm giving this straight up return on equity. If you looked at the cash and backed that out, I mean, those numbers are of course even higher. So very, very, very attractive returns on shareholder capital consistently. And, you know, if you went back before 2008, the returns have been well into the 20s for a long, long period of time. So this gets to the cash, and I'm blending time periods here a little bit, to be fair, and I'll take you through that. I'm using year-end 2012 numbers, but cash and cash equivalents, 2.1 billion Swiss francs, marketable securities and financial assets, another 844. They have an investment in a company called Also, which they own about 28.4%. Using a recent market quotation on Also, that's about 172 million. They also own an investment in Hyundai Elevator, about 35%. Up until recently, that was on the books for $409 million, and they've taken a write-down on that, so I'm reflecting the new value of $254 million, and the market value is around these numbers. I'm happy to talk more to Hyundai Elevator in the Q&A, but basically it's been a difficult situation for Schindler. They don't have any board seats. They are not having... they believe they had a letter of intent to buy the whole company. There's been some lawsuits back and forth. The company has not done well, but it's not because of the underlying elevator business. There's been some derivatives contracts flowing through to the benefit of another company in the Hyundai group, and so that has led to losses at Hyundai Elevator. We'll see how this all turns out over time. I'm sure Schindler's preference would be to either exit it or buy it, and probably to buy it, but so far they've been blocked in those efforts. So you add all that up, there's $3.5 billion in cash and cash-like assets, if you will, against debt of about $754 million. That leaves you with a net cash position of $2.7 billion or 2330 Swiss francs per share. So by any definition, a pristine balance sheet here for Schindler, we think that's important in terms of assessing the quality of a business. In terms of operating margins, you can see they're well above, 10% and increasing. Now, this is a key part of our argument and why we particularly like Schindler. Schindler's margins, for a variety of reasons, have been below both KONE and Otis, and we think there's no reason why they can't increase their margins over time. And, you know, they were committed to raising their margins over a period of a couple years up into the 14s range, and they've recently backed off from that. And we think for actually sound reasons, because the growth has been higher in China and India than they first envisioned. And we're okay with that because, again, that will lead to more maintenance and, business down the road, and those margins will increase down the road. But I would just make the comment that if you're looking for a bit of an outlier here, they are well below Otis and KONE's margins, and we think that creates an opportunity for further benefit financially down the road. So let's just give you a quick sense of both the revenue the last couple of years and the makeup of that revenue. You can see in 2012, still almost half the business comes from Europe. Of course, Europe has been weak, but the growth in Asia Pacific has been very good. So revenues went up just under 6% last year, but you can see the order backlog jumped 10%. So we think the revenue picture looks pretty solid for the next few years. And again, I remind you, every time you get new or you get order backlog, then you also get more maintenance business in the future. So good company performing well from a revenue and order backlog perspective. So let's, I'm just choosing some highlights here. Clearly high returns on shareholder capital consistently, well above 20, sometimes into the 30s, while carrying substantial cash balances. So we think they've demonstrated some very attractive returns over the long term. Strong balance sheet. Again, the cash position that I alluded to earlier. Although they do have some debt, they have significant net cash position. We think that's a good thing. Solid competitive position. So again, four main players with over 80% of the business. They're the number two. We think they're in a pretty solid competitive position on a global basis. And then this notion of improving margins, and we'll see whether there can be further improvements over time, but certainly we think that's one of the hidden stories here that can lead to some pretty attractive improvements in the numbers over time. So does it have honest and capable management? And I'm here to tell you, as I'm sure some of the other presenters and probably your own experience will tell you, it's hard. It's very hard to assess the quality of management, and I'd be lying to you if I said we hadn't made mistakes in the past, but we certainly try. And so I'm going to bring in three pillars here at once and talk about them, because this company is slightly unusual from the perspective that the strong family participation is of interest to us. So does the management team think and act like owners? Yes, they do own shares. Yes, they have long-term incentive programs tied around tangible performance targets. The management team's been there a long time. Jürgen Tindgren, Eric Aumann, the CFO, Jürgen Tindgren, the CEO, they've been there with the company for a long period of time, so that stability is good. But what we really like about this company is that it's in the fourth generation from a family perspective, and you have this strong family participation. The Schindler-Bonnard families own over 50 million registered shares. This is their primary wealth creator, and they are paying attention, and certainly Alfred Schindler is the current chairman of Schindler, and Luc Bonnard is the vice chairman. And so that to us is something that we really like. You've got good numbers, but yet you've got a family here that's in the fourth generation. Clearly they think long term about the business. Can it be purchased at an attractive price? I don't really have anything earth-shattering to share with you here. Taking a market price at the end of June of 131.60 Swiss francs, earnings per share, there you can see it's 20 times earnings. Looking at 2012, taking the midpoint of the company's own estimates for what they think their range of expectations is for this year, it's still at 20 times. So all I've done down below is backed out that 23.30 Swiss francs per share, and I think that certainly makes the price more palatable. So 17, almost 18 times trailing, 16.5 times current earnings, x the cash. That makes it more attractive. I'm certainly not going to come in front of you all and say that it's a table-pounding buy here. I think you would do okay from here, but certainly we've been experiencing very volatile markets, particularly in Europe, and it's not beyond the realm of possibility that you may get a chance to buy this at a low double-digit multiple at some point, or even below 15 times earnings, which we would think would at least be reasonable. And then I've just put down below a 1.67% dividend yield. They've had a history of raising the dividend over time, but the payout ratio is still quite low. On a little over $6 a share in earnings last year, they're paying out $2.20. So there would also be room to take the payout ratio up. This is not a company that requires consistently huge capital expenditures over time. They've been a little bit above trend line because they're expanding in China and India and building a new plant in China, building a new plant in India. But ongoing, we think about 100 to 120 million is sort of the maintenance CapEx level that's required on a company like this. So they would have the room if they so chose to increase the dividend. They have been buyers of shares over at various points in their history as well. We actually think they've been pretty astute buyers and have tended to, unlike a lot of companies that have a consistent share repurchase program and are buying back, set amounts each and every month or each and every year, this is a company that'll step on the gas when they think the shares are priced right and maybe slow down a little bit when they think they're not as attractively priced. So But again, I guess I would just say on very simple parameters, remember our comments to try and stick to the basics. You got a company that's basically trading at 16 times earnings that we think is has a demonstrated track record of success. And so although you do fine, I think at 16 times, that's, I guess, more or less a market multiple depending on what markets you're using. But we don't think it's a table pounding buy here. Key takeaways. Well, I'll just summarize for you very quickly, and then we can get to question the Q&A session. But a very favorable competitive landscape. As I mentioned earlier, four companies with over 80%, perhaps as much as 90% of the market outside of China. You know, even if you include China, two-thirds to 70% of the market, those are pretty impressive and a dominant competitive position for the four players in the business. Attractive business model, so this is the notion of maintenance being the key, and that it's at much higher margins, but every new installation and every refurbishment program leads to increasing installation over time. So we think that's something that's pretty attractive. Obviously, high returns on shareholder equity. We talked about that earlier, but that's a bedrock principle for us in terms of assessing whether something may have moat-like characteristics or not. And I would just say Schindler's been doing it for a long, long time through thick and thin. Pristine balance sheet, we talked about that, the huge cash position. We think that's something that's important. It gives you flexibility, whether that's with respect to share repurchases or acquisitions over time. You know, certainly a couple years ago, they acquired 46% of a Chinese elevator company with an option to buy it all out in the future without, you know, the pristine balance sheet that they have. That opportunity may have been something that they might have passed on, but they had the cash, and so we think that's important. Finally, you know, revenue growth. This is a company that's growing its earnings over time, or growing its revenue, excuse me, over time, and then you have this. They have been improving their margins, so you get that double dip to earnings, if you will, where you can grow revenues and improve margins. We think the opportunity to improve margins quite significantly still from here is something that is a possibility for Schindler as well. So to wrap it up, if you go back to our three questions and think of how we think about our business, you know, we think Schindler's a great business. We think it's run by great people. Certainly the family participation over four generations is something that we like. And if not at a great price, it's still at an okay price, but, you know, you may get a great price at some point. So with that, I'd just wrap it up and try and leave lots of time for questions.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for those remarks. I just want to remind everyone that if you have a question, you can type it into the online interface and we will ask it. Let's get started here on some of the questions that have come in. Let's see. You talked about the maintenance as a share of profits, roughly. What about as a share of revenue? Any sense of that?
Well, again, they don't disclose it, but we believe it is at least half of the business. Certainly, if you look at Kone, I don't recall the numbers from the most recent year, but I think they've been up about, you know, 60-65% is from maintenance. So it's Schindler can sometimes be a bit secretive in terms of they feel that reveals something competitively that they don't want to reveal. But let's just say we think it's at least revenue at least half, and we think it's at least two-thirds, if not more, of the profits.
How long are the maintenance contracts generally? Is there a term that they usually enter into?
There's a lot of variability there. Certainly, the longer you'll commit, you tend to get a bit of a price break. I would say loosely they run on about an annual basis. But again, there's not a lot of churn, if you will. They may be annual contracts, but they tend to come back to Schindler the next year and year after year. And that's just, although there's nothing that prohibits an outside maintenance contractor from servicing the Schindler elevator, you know, Schindler built it, they know it. There tends to be, to a large degree, a lot of stickiness in those maintenance contracts, regardless of the term.
Can Otis or ThyssenKrupp perform maintenance on Schindler's elevators and escalators?
Yes, they can. Likewise, Schindler can perform maintenance on the others. But over time, it tends not to work out that way. And I will, by way of analogy, use cars. So, you know, you could technically take your Mercedes to a Toyota dealership or your Lexus to a Mercedes dealership, but that tends not to happen in reality because there's an expertise about the product that Schindler has about its own elevators, and quite frankly that Otis and Thiessen and Kone have about their elevators, that leads the landlords or the owners of those elevators to want to have them serviced by the manufacturer.
Is there any differentiation you could talk about among the top four players?
It's interesting. I mean, they will all talk about the competitive advantage of their product offering over other product offerings. To be honest with you, I don't think the differentiation is as great as you might think. And so again, think about these low margins on installation, and I'm going to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek here, but you should almost give away these elevators to lock in the maintenance march as quickly as you can to the largest market share. Now, in reality, of course, that's not happening, and most of the manufacturers are getting those 5 to 10 to 12% margins on new installations and refurbishments. But to answer your question specifically, although at different points in time, one will leap ahead of another, you know, certainly solar is something that's getting some interest right now. Schindler has its port technology that involves some identification of individuals and what floors they're allowed to go to and that sort of thing in an elevator. And so that's a bit of a differentiator at the moment. But my experience over time is, That's not the way the business has evolved. There's not a lot of differentiation between the four main players, and I see it more as a market share and distribution.
Are any long-term trends evident from the market share picture among these four players?
If anything, I would say that Schindler's been a little bit slower to grow in Asia Pacific, you know, and that the others have picked up, but they are ramping up and, you know, are building, have built or are building or expanding their facilities in both India and China. So, you know, they've made a commitment, and I think maybe they've been a little bit slower relative to particularly Kone and Otis, but, you know, there hasn't been any discernible, huge, game-changing market share changes over time.
Is there evidence of long-term pricing rationality in the sector, given that there are these four major players?
I mean, absolutely. And, I mean, you see that in 2008 and 2009, although revenues went down for Schindler and the others, it certainly didn't mirror the drop that you would find in construction starts and that sort of thing. And so, again, that's partly the maintenance, but it's also some price rationality around the new installation and refurbishment.
Has the company explained why margins are below Otis or Kone and what the source of that is so that we know whether there's expansion potential?
Well, part of it has been in the immediate past is that because they were a bit behind in some of these new markets, they've been doing more install and getting more install business. So the more install you get, in the short run, that impacts your margins, right? Because that's at a lower margin. I think that they've been slower to globalize their business than some of the other players. So, big production facilities in Switzerland, for example, at, margins, they haven't been able to get the margin growth that some of the other two, mainly Kone and Otis, have been able to get by rationalizing their facilities. So, again, we think that's what creates a bit of an opportunity because they may be a bit slower to get there, but I think they have religion now about trying to do all those things and improve the margins over time.
How is Schindler's position vis-a-vis the suppliers that they use? Is there any concentration among the suppliers? Are these kinds of commodity-type components or commodities that they use?
That's a great question. Nothing that I can point to specifically. There's a lot of I'll call it assembling as opposed to manufacturing done by all of the players. So you get some, think almost like auto companies where, the tier one suppliers are bringing in almost a prefab solution for part of an automobile. You get that component type building for the elevator business, but certainly nothing specific that I can point to. And again, they haven't had huge swings in their earnings and net income that would lead you to the conclusion that there's commodity price shift that's really affecting that affect them. And again, certainly the maintenance part of the equation offsets that as well. So even to the extent that you get commodity pricing, if less than half the business is coming from, the installation and retrofit business, the commodity effect of price increases or decreases, but mainly price increases, is at least moderated because of the maintenance business.
Would you consider owning any of the other top four players, especially given that the number one player is a subsidiary of a U.S.-listed company?
I mean, the numbers that you see out of Otis are good, and in the right circumstance, we would love to own a pure Otis. Of course, the problem is that it's buried inside United Technologies, and without... I'll just sidestep the issue, is United Technologies attractive in total or not? I'm not going to comment on that, but the fact of the matter is you can't get a pure play on Otis. Kone is a fine business in certain circumstances. We could certainly see ourselves owning Kone, but it is more expensive. I mean, from an earnings multiple point of view, just to use one simple measure, it's 24, 25 times earnings. Now, yes, it has higher margins today than Schindler, but the way we calibrated it, we just like the valuation better on Schindler. But then with ThyssenKrupp, same thing. You're buried inside. You can't get the pure play on elevators. So I'm ruling out, you know, again, without commenting on the valuations of United and Thiessen specifically and their investment merits, the simple fact of the matter is you're not getting a pure play with either of those two players, and so it comes down to Kone or Schindler, and right or wrong, we've cast our vote for Schindler.
What do you consider more likely, that the top four global players gain market share in China, or that the Chinese companies expand overseas?
I think quite definitely the former. And again, it's because a lot of the Chinese manufacturers are only supplying the low end in China or the social housing end. You know, already large office complex in Shanghai or Beijing or a hotel complex, the international players are already getting most of that business. And then it's this notion of creating the maintenance service business on top of that, although there's been an agency network in China that's getting some of the servicing business today. All the big players are rapidly building out their service component, and again, we just think that the owner of an elevator, a landlord, a hotel, is just not going to risk maintenance, giving the maintenance to an independent agent when they can have the manufacturer's representative on site. But of course, the key's been to build out that service network. And certainly Schindler, particularly in the last couple of years, has been really building out the number of offices or service facilities that they have in China. So although you don't know for sure, my bet would be that the dominance of the international, the four big players, continues, and they will pick up share in China over time.
I'd like to go to Oliver for a couple of questions next.
Jeff, from a customer's perspective, can you talk about the value proposition based on your comment earlier about how it would probably makes sense to give those out for free and then just do a lot of maintenance? Have there been any studies done or have you seen any data about the total cost of these installations to customers and how these competitors stack up in that respect?
Really, no. I don't have anything overly insightful to say in that regard. I mean, obviously, I was being a little tongue-in-cheek about, giving away elevators for free. Certainly, you do have capital costs to do an install, and it's nice to make some money on that. Again, for me, the key is on the maintenance side, it's just not something that you can afford to go with the cheapest option. I just think that that's the attractiveness of this business model. The liability associated with capturing some modest savings on the maintenance side of the business, I just don't think that's an attractive risk reward for most of the owners of these escalators and elevators. And I might just add that, you know, the complexity, of course, rises with verticalization, if you will, and so that even is more of an issue in a building that's very tall.
And then I was curious about, are there any differences between the escalator and elevator business that are perhaps important for investors to consider? It would seem that the elevator business is perhaps more mission critical or needs to be more reliable versus the escalator business. What's your view on that?
Well, certainly I would concur. I would just say that if you're the owner of a shopping mall and your escalator's not working, you've got a lot of grumbling, upset patrons going through your mall. I mean, I readily concede the point, but I don't think it's that the differences are extreme. Certainly, high-rise elevators, there is a more mission-critical aspect to it, but I wouldn't say it's dramatically so over other mobility solutions like escalators.
Great. Well, I want to turn it back to John for any other remarks. John?
Thank you, Oliver. Here's a question on Hyundai Elevator, which is publicly traded in Korea. Do you have any thoughts on that company?
Well, Schindler, as I mentioned in my presentation, Schindler owns about 35%. It's been a problem because it's not really a pure play elevator company. They've been engaging in some various derivative activity that's creating losses. Schindler's contention is that that's to help other parts of the Hyundai Kaibel. You know, it just hasn't been very, very profitable. So certainly I wouldn't, I'm certainly not endorsing it as an investment. I mean, I would very much love if Schindler could resolve that situation. And, you know, obviously our preference would be that they're able to buy out Hyundai Elevator. It is a major player in the Korean market. So that would be interesting, and I think valuable if that could happen, at the right price. But clearly there's a lot of animosity between the two parties and lawsuits flying back and forth and court injunctions and that sort of thing. So it's not a very great environment between the two parties at the moment. So I don't expect that to be resolved anytime soon.
A couple of more general questions, Jeff, on Widemode businesses. What is your process for finding these types of businesses?
blind luck? No. I mean, obviously we do a lot of reading. We're not big screeners necessarily. I mean, certainly you develop over a period of time cumulative knowledge about businesses and industries and specific names. John, I think you made a comment in your latest editorial in your latest issue of your publication that, you know, one of the benefits of being a Widemode investor is that you can sit and you can think about a company for a long, long time, and that knowledge is cumulative as opposed to the pure Ben Graham type value investor who's screening everything and looking for the cheapest securities. And so I'm not sure I can give you a very good answer to the question other than to say I don't have very much hair. What I do have is mainly gray. I've been doing this for 30 years, and you hope to build up some knowledge of what constitutes a great business over time. And with that, with the full humility that, you know, judging the sustainability of a competitive advantage is just very, very difficult to do. And oftentimes when you think you've got a moat, you really don't, because it attracts competition that can break down that moat. And so said with a lot of humility, you do make mistakes. But over time, I think we've just been able to develop some cumulative knowledge, and you're always looking and you're always trying to improve. Certainly at our firm, we go ever more global year by year by year. So that also opens up a greater universe for you to consider. And so it's just a lot of fun. It's like a big jigsaw puzzle trying to learn what companies have inherent and enduring sustainable competitive advantages.
I'll take one last question, and that is, how do you decide to sell a Widemode company?
Again, that's That's a very difficult proposition. And I will give you an example. We still have a small position in Nike. And, you know, we wrestle with it, and we've been sellers along the way. We've done fabulously well owning Nike over the years on for the benefit of our clients in our funds. But we just feel it's at least to the expensive end. But the problem is that if you have a good wide moat business that can grow over time with some consistency, even though it may appear expensive today, if that moat's there and it keeps on performing, you know, a year or 2 years, most of that premium tends to be worked off. It's very rare that you see one of these companies go to such an excessive valuation that it's just obvious to be a seller. So, you know, without defining this precisely, but if I wake up and, you know, something we owned was at 40 or 50 times earnings, yeah, we'd likely be a seller, because now you're at, even if we thought that business would continue to perform, you're at such a premium that it's going to be a considerable period of time to work that premium off. But oftentimes, you get trapped into making sales, or you make sales because you think you're at full valuations. The business continues to perform, and that premium gets worked off very, very quickly. So I have to be honest with you and say we haven't been particularly astute sellers over the years of our companies. We try to get the buy side of the equation right by truly trying to dig in and understand what we own. But all that's a long-winded way of saying it's fair that the sell decision is very, very difficult.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank all of you for attending this session and for attending the summit. We do have a number of pre-recorded sessions available in the online conference area for all of you to enjoy. Also, this and the other live sessions will be available for replay there as well. Jeff, a huge thanks to you for taking the time to share your considerable insights as well as this particular idea with us today.